First off, I really didn't want to come out about being gay and having AIDS to the whole world and pulling my pants down and telling everything. You know, basically I bared my soul in the book, my family, everything. I didn't want to do that. But friends that went through the things with me that are chronicled in Signals kept saying, this is bigger than you and you need to share it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Gay and lesbian civil rights are recognized for the first time in Japan. Traditionally wedded Hindu lesbians vow to fight for marriage rights in India and reading the life and death signals from gay men with AIDS. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Donald Herman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 2nd, 2001. Japan has officially recognized the civil rights of gays and lesbians for the first time. An advisory panel explicitly recognized widespread anti-gay discrimination in its final report to the Ministry of Justice and named it as a target for positive action by a National Human Rights Commission that will be established in about 2 years. Although gays and lesbians consulted with the panel as well as testifying at its public hearings, their inclusion in the report was controversial. They were dropped from some drafts as Justice Ministry officials declared the Japanese public wasn't ready to see their rights protected. The international community joined Japanese activists in demanding inclusion, and the final report is viewed as a victory for their action. The creation of the Japanese Human Rights Commission still requires passage by the national parliament, the Diet, where the government will introduce a bill in a few months. There are no national laws in Japan to protect gay and lesbian civil rights, but gay and lesbian activists say the Human Rights Commission could serve as a good substitute.
In India, a Hindu priest used a traditional ceremony to marry a lesbian couple in the newly formed central state of Chhattisgarh. One woman now wears the megalstero, traditional for married Hindu women, while the other wears the macho taviz. Local residents of their town of Ambikapur were shocked and concerned. The priest submitted documents to the local registrar to legalize the marriage, but the registrar refused to accept them. The couple, Jaya Verma and Tanuja Chahan, have vowed to fight for legislation for equal marriage rights for lesbians and gays.
In Canada, both the Manitoba and Saskatchewan governments this week introduced omnibus bills to amend a number of provincial laws to give gay and lesbian couples legal status equal to their unmarried heterosexual counterparts. The bills are intended to bring the provinces into compliance with a landmark 1999 decision by the Supreme Court of Canada, something Ontario, Quebec, and British Columbia have already done. Unlike other provinces, the Manitoba bill would not empower gays and lesbians to co-adopt their partner's children. Manitoba's attorney general said that right had not been part of the Supreme Court ruling, which dealt primarily with financial issues, especially alimony.
In Quebec, the Montreal suburb of Pointe-Claire was thronged with marchers protesting the homophobic harassment of a gay male couple. Estimates of the crowd ranged from 2,000 to 5,000 as Montrealers arrived by the busload. Theo Wooters and Roger Thibault lived peacefully in Pointe-Claire for more than 20 years until Robert Walker moved in next door to them in 1997. Walker's continuing homophobic harassment of the couple has at times escalated to physical violence. He'll be tried for assault later this year for attacking them with golf balls and with his car. Pointe-Claire Mayor Bill McMurtry further irritated gay and lesbian activists when he tried to impose a dress code on the protest and asked that a rally on a football field replace the march. But a line of people more than a kilometer long followed a banner saying, "No to intolerance, no to homophobia," falling completely silent as they passed the homes of the couple and their harasser. Wooter said, "I'm just floored. I didn't know that I have so many friends."
With the help of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, a suspect was charged in New Jersey this week for two in a series of grisly murders of gay men in the early 1990s. Richard Rogers Jr. was charged with the murders of Thomas Mulcahy and Anthony Marrero. They were among at least five victims whose dismembered remains were discovered in trash bags near New Jersey highways. At the time, the killings were referred to as the work of the last call killer, so-called because the perpetrator was believed to have picked up the victims at New York City gay bars. Rogers' arrest came when the Mounties were able to lift fingerprints from the trash bags, and computer matching connected them with his 1973 arrest in Maine. He'd been charged there with manslaughter in the hammer slaying of Frederick Spencer, but claimed he'd acted in self-defense and was found not guilty. Rogers is now being investigated in connection with trash bag murders from Connecticut to Pennsylvania.
The U.S. observance of Memorial Day this week featured the dedication of the nation's first gay-inclusive monument in a military cemetery. More than 100 people came to Desert Memorial Park in Cathedral City, California, for the ceremony, which included a color guard carrying the rainbow flag along with the banners of the four branches of the armed forces. The monument marks 2 years of work by local lesbi-gay veterans who formed AmVets Post 66 for the purpose. It's a rainbow granite block whose plaque bears triangles and the message, "This memorial is dedicated in honor of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender veterans who gave the ultimate sacrifice for the cherished freedom we hold dear and enjoy today."
There were other significant developments regarding the U.S. military this week as well. The Department of Defense announced that gay-related discharges reached a new high in the year ending September 30, 2000. A total of 1,212 service members were discharged, almost all for stating their sexual orientation. That's a 17% increase over the previous year, which had been down slightly after a steady increase since the adoption of the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Of the four service branches, only the Air Force showed a decrease in gay and lesbian discharges in the latest figures.
A gay psychiatrist will have to repay the U.S. Air Force for the cost of his education. The Air Force sought to recover $71,000 from former Captain Dr. John Hensala, who was discharged after telling superiors he is gay. Hensala insisted that he was perfectly willing to fulfill the service obligation he contracted for in exchange for his education. But a federal judge said Hensala should pay up because he came out voluntarily and presumably understood what the likely consequences would be.
A legal panel charged with reviewing the 50-year-old Uniform Code of Military Justice recommended repealing its sodomy statute. The commission's report railed against criminal prosecution of consensual sex acts, including homosexual acts and adultery, and noted that sodomy suspects are treated in an arbitrary, even vindictive manner. Changes to the military code require an act of Congress.
In the corporate sphere, ExxonMobil shareholders issued a resounding defeat to a proposal to add sexual orientation to its equal employment policy. Before the 1999 merger that created the world's largest oil company, Mobil had such a policy, as well as domestic partner benefits. The ExxonMobil board opposed explicitly prohibiting anti-gay discrimination, claiming its current policy is adequate. This is the third year the proposal has been put to a vote, initiated by activist shareholders including Trillium Asset Management. Support has increased each time, reaching a high of 13% this year. Under Securities and Exchange Commission rules, that's enough to allow the proposal to be reintroduced next year, unlike the nine other shareholder-initiated proposals considered at the same meeting.
Three women celebrities made headlines this week with something less than lesbian pride. Australian Olympic champion swimmer Dawn Fraser launched her new autobiography, admitting to two significant relationships with other women, but still rejecting the label gay. A four-time gold medalist in the 1950s and 60s, Fraser was the first woman to win gold in three consecutive Olympics. After the breakup of her troubled marriage, she was involved with the late scriptwriter Joy Cavill, but was ashamed and confused by the sexual part of their relationship. Her second female partner remains unnamed, but they opened and ran a cheese shop together. Although she described both relationships as incredibly supportive, she told reporters, "I see myself as a woman who had a couple of relationships with other women and then found it wasn't for her."
U.S. film actress Anne Heche's manager confirmed this week that she is engaged to be married to a man, camera operator Coley LaFoon. The couple met while filming a documentary about open lesbian Ellen DeGeneres, Heche's very public partner for 3.5 years until their breakup in August. Heche was a speaker at the Gay and Lesbian Millennium March on Washington, D.C.
And as Rosie O'Donnell accepted her fourth Daytime Emmy Award for her daily talk show, she said, "I love you," to Kelly, the woman tabloids have described as her lover. Reports in New York publications in March had also led some to think that her plans to end the talk show, which she's always intended to be accessible to children, might also end her silence on the subject. When DeGeneres' very public coming out had been telegraphed but not yet made official, she and O'Donnell had exchanged a series of humorous hints on O'Donnell's show.
And finally, as for actor Tom Cruise's continuing legal battles against being identified as gay, diva Bette Midler may have the last word. She told Salon.com last week, "All these rumors about him being gay, I don't believe it. I don't believe it for one minute. He hasn't been to one of my shows."
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 2nd, 2001. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Donald Herman.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
20 years ago this week, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control first documented the syndrome then identified as gay-related immune deficiency. Today, the worldwide AIDS epidemic is clearly not a gay disease anymore, although the CDC's latest figures disputed by some activists, indicate a rise in the infection rate among gay men, particularly in younger African Americans. Statistics notwithstanding, there's no debate about the impact of AIDS on gay culture. One of the most recent examples is Joel Rothschild's Signals, the true story of two friends living with full-blown AIDS who make a pact that whoever dies first will attempt to contact the other from beyond. Since its publication a year ago, this little book that could has become a phenomenon, embraced by fans as diverse as Deepak Chopra and Elizabeth Taylor. With music by songwriter and long-term AIDS survivor Steve Shacklin, This Way Out's Steve Pride talks with Joel Rothschild about life, death, and the impressive challenges of mortality.
Benjamin Franklin once said that best friends are one soul and two bodies. In his debut book, Signals, Joel Rothschild shares a story of facing death and instead losing his best friend, Albert.
"It's not that I'm not grateful, I didn't want to die, but when I met the Reaper just before he passed me by, he fixed me a martini, then he told me pretty lies, then ran away. He promised he would free me from this life of endless pain, that he could make me happy, I had only peace to gain. And then he disappeared and I was left with something just a bit less hazardous. The life of Lazarus."
In the time that I've lived with full-blown AIDS, over 19 million people have died. The population of New York and LA combined.
"I found a certain kind of peace, and though it might sound terrible, I was looking forward to the end, but still I'd fight for each new day."
In May of 1994, I was on chemotherapy for chaos on my lungs. I was 90 pounds. I had gone through 7 opportunistic infections, 5 bouts of pneumocystis pneumonia, I had 32 T-cells. And my doctor said, "You know, you're able to travel now and you're walking around, but we don't know how long you're going to be like this. Go home and say goodbye to your family. Go home and say goodbye to your friends." Albert was the love of my life, my best friend, my light, my everything. And I thought, you know, I want to be with Albert at the end, but there's people I want to make peace with. I had a very dear friend in Atlanta I want to say goodbye to. I want to say goodbye to my family. So I decided I would go back. And I made arrangements with Albert that I would come back on June 4th, 1994. And the whole time I was traveling, I took a few weeks to see family and friends. I had this nagging thought, I need to get back to L.A. Something's wrong in L.A. All of my friends at that time were sick. Everyone had AIDS. My whole core group of friends were extremely sick. Albert was HIV positive, but in perfect health. And we had all decided at that time, it was pre-protease, there wasn't a window of opportunity for hope. AIDS was everywhere. There's hope now. It's a different saga. At that time, we were inundated with sadness every day. Do you remember those days when you couldn't go to the grocery store without seeing a bag boy that was dying? We had all talked about suicide. We had gone to Mexico and got the suicide drugs, and we all read Final Exit and decided that if one of our friends would take their own life, we would support them. And as many of the close friends as possible would be there with that person, which was not uncommon. It's like unheard of today, but this is what we did. Albert and I had a commitment that we'd spend the last 24 hours together, and I thought that I would be the person that was committing suicide. I thought I would come back, probably have a couple good weeks, and then I would take my own life. We had a side agreement that whoever died first would contact the other one if there was any hope or possibility to signal each other. I was a card-carrying member of the National Atheist Association, the ultimate skeptic. Why did I go along with the agreement? Was because he was Catholic, he was incredibly spiritual, and I was patronizing him. And I was also thinking, this is the kindest person I've ever known in my life. If there is a God, he's certainly someone that earned a favor from God, and that God would allow me to flick a little light in his room. So I went along with the pact, taking it very seriously. I'd always been the big brother, the adult, and I thought, I'm the next one to die. I'm going to try to give him hope if there's a possibility. I came home June 1st, 1994, straight from the airport to his house, opened the door, and I find his corpse. He's dead. In that moment, I went from functioning to completely being a wreck. I was actually hitting his dead body. I was bouncing from crying and vomiting to being angry that he did it. And there was no suicide note at the scene. I needed it desperately in that moment. Now, being an anal retentive queen, he did calligraphy. So he did it on engraved stationery, calligraphied, mailed it to arrive on June 4th. So it killed himself thinking I'm not going to come home and not find him. Find his dead body, need the note then. The police are there, the sheriff's there, coroner's there. I needed that note more than anything that I ever needed in my life. I needed it to know that he still loved me, that he cared about me, that I was in his final thoughts, that our relationship was real. Need the note, clearly hear his voice. Never thought about it, didn't think about it. Clearly hear his voice say, look in the trash behind the house next door and you'll find the suicide note. So like an insane person, I hop the wall, go behind the house next door, find the rough draft to the suicide note. The day before was trash day, and he had put it out on trash day, and then it got wheeled back. That note got me home and opened the door to what became the book, Signals. And that contact with Albert that night is why you can hear my voice today. It's the reason why I'm alive. The core message from Albert in all of this was that every moment of life matters.
Perhaps someday for several hours you'll fill some church with lots of flowers and display some saintly shot of me somewhere in the hall. Stick a tray of nachos up against the wall. I bet my mom will tell a story endowing me with lots of glory and punish you by making you listen to my song, or torture you by forcing you to have to sing along. Then I'll find my way back to the seat in the back, and I'll be a good boy till it's over. Then I'll get to do something that you cannot do. I'll follow you home, every one of you. Then on a day when you feel lost or hurt, go to the kitchen, get some dessert, then sit at the table and eat. Just remember, please remember, to save me a seat. Please remember to save me a seat.
In Signals, Joel writes of a spiritual awakening and a departed friend who not only returned to him that same night, but continues to come to him again and again with specific messages of hope for both friends and strangers.
I knew it was real. I just had this internal debate about its purpose or whether it was worthy or whether I would share it with anyone.
A simple faith, a quiet faith, not complicated, something you feel, and that's what makes it great. It's just a simple faith.
First off, I really didn't want to come out about being gay and having AIDS to the whole world and pulling my pants down and telling everything. You know, basically I bared my soul in the book, my family, everything. I didn't want to do that. But friends that went through the things with me that are chronicled in Signals kept saying, this is bigger than you and you need to share it.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to This Way Out. Today with the author of Signals, Joel Rothschild, and featuring the music of Steve Shacklin. The American Indians believe that the hummingbird carries the soul of the departed, and hummingbirds play a significant role in Joel's story.
Three times I was consoling someone else, and a hummingbird landed on me. Sounds like an oddity, not such a big deal. So as I'm sharing these events with friends, and the last friend that came to mind with the hummingbird story is a woman named Rita Wainer, who's in her 80s, husband, it's not in the book, wrote all the music for Billie Holiday. Brilliant woman, had polio, she was crippled most of her life, or disabled most of her life, and this gregarious and wonderful woman, but an atheist as well. And very dear friend, she's my surrogate grandmother, and as I'm telling her these stories over the course of a year and a half, she's saying, I wish I could believe them. I'd love to believe that I'm going to see my father again and my mother or my husband, but Joel, I just can't believe these stories. I just don't believe them. I love you, and I believe that you believe them, but I don't believe them. We're on the 10th floor of a high-rise on Doheny. Hummingbird flies in the window through sliding glass doors, lands on me, put my little finger out, hops on my finger, passed it to her. She looks at me and she says, I believe you. I have it all. Write the book. That was the last experience, and then I wrote the book.
Joel Rothschild was diagnosed with AIDS in 1986, but self-pity has never been his style.
I had diarrhea from chemotherapy, and in the middle of the evening, well, for me, it was like 10 o'clock at night, I had diarrhea on me, and I was so mad. And I kept saying, why me? I'm so frustrated. So I got myself showered, and I went to get a bite to eat. I'm at a little restaurant towards closing time, and a guy comes in a wheelchair. And I thought, oh, at least I could get up and get a shower. And as I'm looking at his wheelchair, he's got a gay flag tied to it, and he's got a gay bumper sticker, and he's got an Amnesty International sticker on it. And I had a copy of my book, and I thought, I'm going to sign to a hero and give it to him. But he was so paralyzed, he had only movement in his face where he could blink in one eye, one finger could move, and he could talk. And he had a nurse spoon-feeding him. And I walked up to him, and I go to give him my book. I had it open to a page, and he says, Joel, how are you? I haven't seen you in 10, 12 years. I didn't recognize him. And he says, you look fantastic. And when you haven't seen someone with AIDS for 10 years, you think they might be dead. Still don't recognize him. I told him I had written this book and life was going good. Hand him the book. He says, oh, you wrote to a hero. You must know my story. Right as he said that, I recognize him. He was this beautiful, handsome man that I had remembered, this athletic guy and gregarious, wonderful person. I started to cry. Here I am with someone in a wheelchair that's totally disabled, more than quadriplegic, has no movement in his fingers. He says, you must have heard my story. You wrote to a hero. And I said, no, I don't. And I'm starting to cry. He said, don't cry for me. I have the greatest life. He said, let me tell you my story. After my lover died, I started riding in the California AIDS rides. And I was on Nichols Canyon practicing for one of the AIDS rides, and I got hit by a car, and they broke my neck. They took me to Cedars, and I was flat on my back in depression for weeks on end, crying. And then they brought in a kid that was in Northridge High or one of the high schools, and he broke his back playing football. And every day and every morning, he would scream at the nurse, kill me. Give me some morphine. Kill me. I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be a cripple my whole life. Kill me. He said, I had an epiphany. I decided where I would find my meaning in my life. I went back to UCLA. I got my PhD in therapy, and I became a therapist. And I'm on board at Cedars for people that have had life-altering injuries.
I thought, oh my God, this guy went through so much. And I thought, that's really amazing. And then I talked to another friend of mine who got his PhD, said, I remember him in the program. And let me tell you how hard it was for him to get his PhD. And it never crossed my mind. He had no movement. He couldn't write. He couldn't type. How did he get it? He wore glasses that had a laser beam that pointed at a specially adapted screen one letter at a time, and he blinked one letter at a time to be able to type to get his PhD. And they didn't give him any leniency in the program. He still had to compete like every other PhD candidate to get it. So not only did he have to overcome the obstacle once, but he had to overcome it every moment of his life. I thought, that's someone who rose to the occasion. I don't know why I'm telling you that story now, but I think it has some purpose and some meaning. And so as much as I've been through, there's always someone who's been through more and maybe even risen a lot higher.
So what is the lesson that forms the core of Joel Rothschild's philosophy?
The shimmering core for me is that every moment of life matters and that even our suffering has purpose. It may not feel that way. And along those lines, that everything passes and that there is truly a ripple effect to the good deeds that we do and that we're not alone and that we're all in this together and that we're all connected and we're all a part of something bigger and that we have a responsibility to each other and a responsibility to act beyond our primal instincts and to use our higher selves and our higher consciousness and to be kinder and better people.
Earlier this year, Joel Rothschild was honored with the Ribbon of Hope Award at the Television Academy of Arts and Sciences for giving back to the community through his tireless volunteer work. Whether one accepts the events he shares as signals from a dead friend or rejects them as random coincidences, Signals is an inspiring story of one man's journey and inner transformation. The music in this report was performed by songwriter and AIDS survivor Steve Shacklin. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Donald Herman, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambidge, Jason Lynn, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Steve Shacklin performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the CPS Des Guadalupe Fund, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa cardholders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's critical financial status, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. We really need your help. For Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KALW San Francisco, California, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.